Good evening and welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, licensed psychologist, counselor, and marriage and family therapist. Tonight we will be discussing post-traumatic stress disorder. I invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. This evening we have as our guests Dr. Sean McNeil, psychiatrist, and Dr. Jennifer Russell, psychologist. So let's start with you, Sean. Dr. McNeil, tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on the air. I appreciate the opportunity to come and share a little bit about what I do, what we do in the community. So I moved to Shreveport just almost 6 years ago after medical school, came here for my residency and at LSU Health. And after finishing residency in general adult psychiatry, did a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry, and then moved from there to the VA, where right now I'm working in the PTSD clinic. And in addition to that, I work on the editorial board for a journal called the Journal of Addiction Medicine. So that's a big interest of mine as well, is the addiction component. But primarily right now, is from a day-to-day point, I just do PTSD.
Okay, well, thank you for being with us this evening. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Jennifer Russell, tell us about you and what you do.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a Shreveport native and a licensed psychologist. I do a lot of work with survivors of trauma, particularly sexual assault, domestic violence, and also military trauma. I've done some treatment work in that area, both within and outside of the VA. Currently, I'm in private practice doing clinical and forensic work.
So let's start off just by talking about what is post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD?
Okay, well, in a sense, the name says it all. It's a stress reaction following a traumatic event. And there's a lot of different flavors of PTSD. There's a lot of different scenarios that could qualify as trauma. And it's hard to really define that. And even two people experiencing the same type of trauma might have a different reaction. Someone might be deeply affected while someone else is left unaffected. So that's the short answer. It's a person's strong reaction to a traumatic event.
So what kind of experiences can potentially lead to post-traumatic stress disorder?
Okay, well, when I was thinking about this, it seems that there's a few broad categories, some that might be a little bit more obvious. So when we think about PTSD, a lot of times we think about abuse. Sexual abuse, physical abuse, and sometimes verbal and other psychological abuse. And that's one broad category. Of course, with the patient population that I treat, the military trauma, that can result from combat, but also from other aspects of their military service. And then you also think about individuals that have experienced maybe a single traumatic event. Maybe they witnessed something terrible like a car accident or an airplane crash, and then they might have a reaction to an event like that. And then there's, of course, many other scenarios that might qualify as trauma. But I'd say those are the broad and maybe the most common types that we see. And is there maybe something you'd like to add to that?
No, I think that covers it.
Covered it. Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on post-traumatic stress disorder. Call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So how common is post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, in America, over the course of an individual's lifetime, about 9% of people will meet criteria for PTSD. If you look at that by year, about 3.5% of our population will meet criteria in any given year. So it's a pretty common mental health struggle.
So what about symptoms? What are some of the symptoms that are identified as being related to post-traumatic stress disorder?
So the DSM outlines four categories of symptoms that can occur after a traumatic event.
So first of all, what is the DSM?
The DSM is our diagnostic Bible, so to speak. It lays out the different criteria that you use to diagnose different mental health conditions.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
So the DSM gives us basically four different categories of symptoms. The first is going to be what are called intrusion symptoms. And those are going to be things where the person is kind of re-experiencing or reliving the event in some way. That may come in the form of memories of the event itself, nightmares that are related to it, having situations come up where they're feeling emotions that are similar to those that they experienced at the time of the trauma, or physiological reactions that they may have experienced then. The second type are what we call avoidance symptoms. And that's where the person makes efforts to try to not be reminded of the trauma again. So they may avoid certain situations or people. They may try to stifle certain emotions that bring up some of those memories. And then the third category is marked essentially by negative moods, feelings, and thoughts. So the person may feel anxious, depressed. They may have difficulty connecting with other people or feeling positive emotions the way that they did prior to the trauma. They may feel shame or guilt for what happened, or blame themselves or someone else who is not responsible or is not at fault. And then the fourth category are what we call arousal symptoms. And that just means essentially that fight or flight system that protects us all when we're actually in danger kind of gets stuck in an on position, so that it's not switching on and off in response to threat. It kind of stays on all the time, regardless of what's going on around. So this may look like things like irritability, what we call hypervigilance, which is kind of always being on guard, on edge, looking out for danger and a threat, being jumpy, having difficulty sleeping, difficulties focusing and concentrating, those types of things.
So essentially, the person's body is responding as if there's danger when there may not be any significant danger or any danger at all.
That's correct. Yeah.
I invite our listeners to join our conversation on post-traumatic stress disorder. Call with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So if we have a traumatic event that occurs to us, does that mean that we're going to develop PTSD? Would we maybe develop PTSD later on? If we have a trauma, is PTSD going to occur?
Right. Well, there's not an easy way to answer that question. We know that certain factors might make you more susceptible to developing PTSD in the wake of a trauma, but there's no easy way to really determine who's going to be affected and who won't. Do you think that you have anything to add to that?
Yeah. There was a study done where they looked at nearly 3,000 people. This was in the United States. And what they found was that about nearly 9 in 10 Americans have experienced some type of event in their lifetime that would qualify as what we call a Criterion A event, so a traumatic event that could lead to PTSD. However, only about 1 in 12 people will develop PTSD over the course of their lifetime. So there are many more people being exposed to trauma than who actually go on to develop it.
But just because someone does not develop post-traumatic stress disorder, that doesn't mean that they still might not develop some type of trauma reaction or some sort of psychological difficulty because of the trauma.
Right, right. Trauma can have other effects within the mental health realm besides just PTSD, things like other anxiety disorders, depression, those sorts of things.
Yeah, because, post-traumatic stress disorder is something that we often hear of, but there are other types of trauma diagnoses that we also might think of when someone comes in as clinicians with a traumatic experience. So acute stress disorder, that is one of those diagnoses that we might give to someone who is coming in after experiencing a trauma. Would y'all mind talking a little bit about acute stress disorder and exactly what that is?
Right. Well, yeah, an acute stress reaction or acute stress disorder, it can present very similarly to PTSD. And one of the main differences is that time component. You know, when did the trauma happen and when did the symptoms start? Typically, with the acute stress reaction, we'll see the symptoms start within 3 days, and typically last no longer than a month. And once we cross that month threshold, we start getting into PTSD territory. Now, there are cases, though, where PTSD doesn't set in right away. So for an acute stress reaction, usually it happens pretty soon after the trauma. But in PTSD, there are delayed onset cases where it's more than, I believe it's more than 3 months after the event happened. But, you know, clinically, I've seen it start to develop after maybe months or even years. You know, for example, a veteran that comes back from war, you know, maybe doesn't think about it right away or self-medicates or, you know, doesn't necessarily face what's happened. And then they won't develop the PTSD symptoms until a little bit later on. And then, you know, we might see them years down the road in the clinic.
Mm-hmm. So it's not these trauma reactions or trauma symptoms that the person may experience could develop very soon after the trauma, or they may not develop for quite some time after the trauma. But both is possible.
Right.
Right. And they can even develop it at different times. You might get the nightmares right away, but that, you know, the isolation you were talking about, how some patients tend to push themselves away, particularly veterans, you know, sometimes isolate and try to avoid crowds. But some of that might not develop until later on. So, you know, it has an interesting time course.
So the symptoms can kind of wax and wane mm-hmm. depending on what's going on in the person's life? And
it can, and also depending on treatment. You know, if they go ahead and get into treatment, things might get better. But say they go through a period of high amount of stress, and that can make some symptoms come back, you know, that might have been well treated before. We might see a person go from having, you know, being well treated and their nightmares go down to just once a week, and then they go through a period of high stress and then they really come back.
Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on post-traumatic stress disorder. Please call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So if someone is listening to this program, or for some other reason thinks, oh my gosh, you know, I've had a trauma in my life, I'm having some difficulties, I wonder if I have post-traumatic stress disorder, what should they do?
Yeah, the good news is that there are a lot of effective treatments available, and those include things like talk therapies that have been specifically developed and studied for people who are experiencing PTSD, as well as medications that can help control the symptoms. So there's a lot of things that can be done. One resource that I like to point people to is the website for the National Center for PTSD, and that's at www.ptsd.va.gov. That has a lot of information about what PTSD is, how people can help themselves if they're feeling like they're having symptoms, how they can help and be supportive for family members who they may be concerned about. And it's for veterans as well as non-veterans. And it also has information about connecting people to resources and therapy and that type of stuff. So
are there any factors or behaviors or situations that might increase the likelihood that someone will experience a trauma and then develop post-traumatic stress disorder? Are there protective factors, risk factors, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we know quite a bit about the risk factors, and some of those are related to the trauma itself in terms of being predictive of someone having a greater risk of developing PTSD. So some of those factors would be if someone's been exposed to multiple traumatic events and multiple traumatic events across different categories. So maybe someone has experienced a sexual assault, and then they've also experienced some sort of combat trauma while in the military. That person would be at greater risk than someone who just had a single traumatic event. Exposure to specific types of trauma also have higher prevalence rates of PTSD. So rape, genocide, terrorist attacks, things like that have a much higher rate than maybe things like natural disasters or car accidents and those sorts of things. And then during the trauma, the more that a person perceives that they are going to be killed or die, the higher the risk for PTSD in the aftermath of that event. And then we also know that children who experience trauma at the hands of a caregiver or who witness traumatic events being done to their caregiver, so maybe they're witnessing a parent being abused, that group is at much higher risk as well.
And we haven't really talked about children yet, but I want to get to post-traumatic stress disorder in children in just a few minutes. First, I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation on post-traumatic stress disorder. Call with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So before we talk about children and post-traumatic stress disorder, talk a little bit about how post-traumatic stress disorder is diagnosed. How, Jennifer, I know that you and I do a lot of PTSD evaluations, and Dr. McNeil, I'm sure that you probably do some of those too. Would y'all speak a little bit about evaluating, diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder?
Right. Well, you mentioned the DSM. Like, again, that's our Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the Bible of, you know, our profession, so to speak. It has certain criteria, criteria that help us to evaluate, maybe not the traumatic episode and what happened, but their response to it. And although I don't want to read the whole thing, I have it in front of me, and I think it's important to understand at least what we call the A criterion. So, of course, directly experiencing a traumatic event can lead a person to develop PTSD. But there are some other scenarios where this can also happen, including witnessing in person an event that has occurred to someone else. So, for example, like my example of seeing a car crash, you know, you see a terrible accident happen to somebody else, and that can be traumatizing. The next one is learning that a traumatic event has occurred to a close family member or a close friend. That can elicit a very strong reaction in a person and lead to the development of PTSD. And then finally, experiencing repeated or extreme exposure to adverse details of a traumatic event. And the DSM gives some examples here. Say a first responder who has to collect human remains, that can be very traumatizing. Or even a police officer repeatedly exposed to details of child abuse. So, yeah, being exposed to reminders of a very traumatic event can be one of those qualifying criteria.
So when a mental health professional is trying to diagnose PTSD, they're going to do a thorough history interview, specifically asking about any exposure to traumatic events. So any type of abuse that would be, you know, going back to childhood, but also experiences if the person's an adult that they've had as an adult. And understanding that the person may not really want to disclose, and giving them an opportunity to have a comfortable place to do that and that sort of thing, to determine if there is a Criterion A event, one of those traumatic events. And then you're going to do a structured sort of diagnostic interview to target these specific types of symptoms. And there's a lot of overlap with symptoms of PTSD and other types of mental health disorders. So getting a thorough medical and psychiatric history is important so that you can tease apart whether it's PTSD or whether it's one of those other types of trauma reactions or maybe another mental health disorder that's unrelated to the experience of trauma, to get a good, accurate diagnosis that can guide treatment.
Yeah, and you mentioned this, Dr. Russell, that, you know, it's often difficult, extremely difficult for people who are experiencing these symptoms to discuss the trauma because, I mean, who wants to talk about a traumatic event that has occurred to them?
Right.
So doing these evaluations can be very, very difficult. Facilitating that it can be very difficult for the patient also. However, it can really help with treatment planning if you get that proper diagnosis and are able to really figure out exactly what's going on so that you can come up with a good firm treatment plan and make sure that they get those interventions.
Yeah, and I would just add too that there are specific psychological tests that have been designed to help in the assessment of trauma and other more general tools, something like the MMPI-2, that would help the clinician to determine what exactly is going on and to help with that diagnostic process.
And we have a caller. We have Joan from Shreveport. Joan, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Okay. I'm interested in this subject. Have you ever had patients that were completely cured over a lifetime, or is it simply treating the symptoms.
Right. Well, the short answer is that, well, for most mental illness, there's no such thing as a cure per se, but I have had patients go into what I would call a remission, where the symptoms seem to be really well treated, and perhaps we could even back off. For me, I'm a medication provider, so we could back off the medications a little bit. I don't see a return of symptoms, and so while I don't think it's cured, and I can't guarantee that maybe a trigger won't bring back some of those symptoms, it does seem like remission is sometimes possible, but again, it's hard to tell for who the remission might be possible, and which patients are going to do the best with therapy or with medication management. But yeah, I have seen some really great success stories.
Dr. Russell, any comment on that question?
Yeah, I would echo what Dr. McNeil said. It's not as though any provider can just take a magic wand and erase what's happened. But in terms of people learning how to cope, learning how to deal with stressors that might trigger some sort of reaction, I've seen a lot of patients who put in the hard work that's trauma treatment because it's difficult, but who wind up getting much better and at a level where they can either discontinue medications or, stop therapy for a little while and just kind of go on an as-needed basis if something comes up.
Yeah, and as you said, Dr. Russell, it is hard work, but if someone is willing to put in that difficult work, then we do see successes. But I always do caution my clients that, if you go through a particularly stressful time, pay attention. How's your sleep? How's your appetite? Are you having increased nightmares? Are you starting to isolate? Are you starting to become more irritable? Really keep an eye on those things, because just because you're feeling a lot better, that doesn't mean that a stressor can't come along and cause you some difficulties in the future.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I want to invite our listeners to call with your question or comment. And the number is 1-800-552-8502. We are discussing post-traumatic stress disorder, and actually, I believe that we may have another caller. We have Lynn from Kilgore. Lynn, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, I was wondering how PTSD differs from say a parent who has a child with a chronic debilitating illness that may end in death, but that fact is always there with you. Is there a different diagnosis for that situation?
Yeah, it's going to depend a lot on the nature of the child's illness, as well as the nature of the caregiving duties that that parent might have. So there are definitely situations where people are caregivers for their children or a family member, where they're being exposed to some pretty grotesque and difficult things as a result of whatever medical condition is going on. And that experience over time could meet criterion A for PTSD and then lead to some problems. But this is another example as well where it can look very similar to other things. So there's also a process called bereavement, which is essentially a grief process that has gone on to interfere with a person's functioning and that sort of thing. And a lot of those symptoms are going to be similar in terms of, sadness and thinking of the person and maybe having dreams of them, having difficulty, letting go of things that belong to the person and that type of thing. And there are some distinguishing features that would help a clinician to determine whether it's bereavement or whether it's something like PTSD.
So the person could be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or perhaps they would be diagnosed with bereavement or maybe depression. It just depends on what their particular symptoms.
Right. And the nature of mm-hmm. the nature of their exposure mm-hmm. during the course of the illness.
Mm-hmm. And we have another caller. We have Ben from Bossier. Go right ahead with your comment or question, Ben.
Is there treatment that does not involve medication?
Ben, I think that we might have come in on the tail end of your question. Would you repeat it again?
Is there treatment for PTSD that can be done without medication?
Okay.
Especially at the VA.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'll just comment on the VA part, but because we have a psychologist in the room, I'll let her maybe discuss some of those options. Now, again, I'm not here to represent the VA per se, but there are treatment options, therapy options, evidence-based therapies that the VA does offer. And just on a more general note, for any veterans out there, there is stigma when it comes to PTSD, and I don't think that anything should really hold you back from coming in. You know, the VA has open doors and is ready to receive and treat veterans that might be suffering. So, but I can say that, yes, the VA is very focused on therapy. And I'll let Dr. Russell maybe describe some of those therapies because she practices those therapies.
Yeah, there are a number of talk therapy-based treatments that have been scientifically studied and proven to be effective for PTSD symptoms specifically. Two of the most effective ones are what's called CPT, that stands for cognitive processing therapy, as well as PE, or prolonged exposure therapy. And each of those therapies will have a person talking, thinking, sometimes writing about the trauma to get at those avoidance symptoms that are part of the disorder. And examining kind of how has this affected the way that I look at myself, the world, other people, my own safety, the ability to trust other people, and retooling some of the negative impact that those events have had on their thinking. And then that will lead to better feelings, better behaviors, and improved functioning. So, yes, there are definitely treatments available that don't involve medication.
We have another caller. We have Cheryl on the line from Nacogdoches. Cheryl, go right ahead with your question or comment.
So I am a physical therapist, and my question is, do you have any kind of scientific or evidence-based proof that there's a connection to PTSD and chronic pain diagnoses such as fibromyalgia?
That's a good question. To be honest, because I see patients that have both, but is there a link? You know, as far as I know, there's not necessarily a link. I don't see a high number of fibromyalgia cases among the PTSD population versus any other population. But we certainly do see it, see them occurring together.
Yeah, and what the research does show is that people who have experienced a traumatic event experience things like fibromyalgia and chronic health conditions that are general medical conditions at a greater rate than those who don't have that exposure. Now, there's a lot of overlap between that. There's some kind of confounding variables that may be at play, but it does place a person at greater risk. Now, causation is another thing, but...
So doesn't necessarily cause, but there does appear through the research to be some sort of link, and we don't right now know exactly what that might be.
Yes, there's some association, and we're still untangling it.
So I want to invite our other listeners to call in and join our conversation on post-traumatic stress disorder. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. Let's talk a little bit about children and post-traumatic stress disorder. Can children be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes, they definitely can. And the DSM addresses it because their presentation can be a little bit different. Very similar, but different. The DSM actually makes note of the fact that when we're talking about distressing memories, you know, in an adult, it might be very obvious. You know, they can have, they might be able to tell you exactly what they're thinking about, but a child might not be able to express what they're thinking about or what they're experiencing. So it notes that for children older than 6 years old, a repetitive play can occur that might involve themes or aspects of the traumatic event. And in addition to that, the content of their dreams, they might not be able to either fully express or fully remember what's going on in their dreams, but they might have these repetitive, frightening dreams. So I'll just give an example. Veterans that have recurring nightmares tend to be able to tell you about the nightmares in most cases. And a lot of times there's a military theme to the nightmares, but children might not be able to explain it. So they don't have recognizable content to their dreams necessarily.
Yeah, and sometimes what I've found with children is that they can experience a traumatic event, but it's not until maybe a few years later that they really understand the trauma, that then they begin to maybe experience some symptoms, specifically sometimes with traumatic sexual abuse. The child at the time of the abuse may not really understand what has happened to them, but as they grow a little bit older and have a greater understanding of what has occurred, then they may begin to develop some symptoms. Mm-hmm. And you were mentioning in the play, I know that I've had children who perhaps were in a particularly gruesome car accident or something like that, maybe lost a parent in the motor vehicle accident, and they would actually take the cars in my office and you know, ram the cars together and kind of almost reenact the trauma. So adults can come in and describe the trauma to us, but children sometimes will actually act out the trauma when they have, you know, experienced something particularly difficult or traumatic.
Right. Yeah, children can, they reveal a lot in the way that they play with toys, but also, if you just have them sit down and draw a picture, mm-hmm. sometimes it brings a lot to the surface, and maybe there's something that you notice, and you can ask them. It gives an opportunity to ask more questions.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller. We have Brian from Shreveport. Brian, go right ahead with your question or your comment.
It's a question. Can someone experience PTSD? And then actually, with or without therapy, I guess grow out of it, or after a certain period of time, no longer be affected by it?
So, Guess, what are your comments about that?
Yeah, that's certainly possible, where someone will experience symptoms of PTSD and then without any type of formal treatment will at some point progress to the point where they no longer would meet criteria for that disorder. Sometimes that's because they found some things that are naturally therapeutic for them and have kind of worked through it on their own, or, you know, talking to friends and having social support and some of those protective factors that we know are helpful. The research has recently been focusing on those people who are kind of spontaneous recoverers to help identify some of those resiliency factors, to see if there are any that we can, you know, that are not just inherent to the person, but things that we could try to develop in people to help them, to help boost their natural recovery.
And just, you know, from a clinical standpoint, I've seen, you know, because PTSD, it involves a variety of symptoms. I've seen some symptoms get a little bit better quicker. Like in my population, I see that a lot of times the isolation continues even into older age. But sometimes the nightmares seem to fade a little bit over time. And so, that you know, they'll kind of go from having more nightmares to fewer nightmares as they get older. And that's just something I've noticed.
I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation at 1-800-552-8502. This evening, we are discussing post-traumatic stress disorder. So, Dr. Russell, you were mentioning a minute ago about some protective factors or resiliency factors. Do you know any of those? Can you discuss those with us a little bit?
Sure. One of the primary ones, whether we're talking about PTSD or mental health in general, is what we call social support. So having people around you who care about you, who take an interest in you, and having those healthy relationships with other people is one of the biggest protective factors. Also, things that we know that are associated with better outcomes after exposure to a traumatic event are higher socioeconomic status, That seems to be protective, and that's probably because it's correlated with access to things like healthcare and preventative care and those types of things. But those are some of them.
So having that really strong support system is going to help go
absolutely
a long way.
Yeah.
So we talked some about counseling and some behavioral treatments. Dr. McNeil, would you talk some about medications and what pharmacological treatments there might be available?
Okay. So yeah, there are a few treatments that are FDA approved, and it tends to start with the antidepressants. And, you know, we use the term antidepressant. It's a broad name for this category of medications that's generally used to treat depression, but they also treat other conditions, such as anxiety, and like I said, a few of them are FDA approved for PTSD. So commonly used medications are sertraline, paroxetine, venlafaxine, and then we have another medication that is FDA approved specifically for the nightmares in PTSD, and that's prazosin. Now, of course, everything is going to depend on the individual. So, you know, I'm not here trying to recommend any medications. I'd recommend you speak to your doctor because, you know, sometimes one medication might work well and another one might not. So it's a process that you have to go through with your doctor.
Yeah, and some of these medications may affect your blood pressure, or they may affect weight gain or things like that. And so it is a conversation you have to have with your prescriber as to whether that particular medication is going to be a good fit for you as far as your overall health and any other medical conditions that might be present.
Right. And another point to touch on is treating the comorbidities. So a lot of times with PTSD, we'll see signs and symptoms of depression, anxiety. In fact, PTSD, prior to the DSM-5, it used to be categorized as an anxiety disorder. And it was only in 2013 they moved it into its own category. But you'll see a lot of overlap with depression and anxiety. So those are really common comorbidities. You want to make sure to catch them and treat them appropriately. And then also substance use disorders are sometimes comorbid with PTSD. And we want to make sure to catch that as well. So you need a full workup from your doctor.
Well, and actually my next question was, is substance abuse associated with post-traumatic stress disorder? And it sounds like you right. just answered that.
You do see, you see cases where some people self-medicate, and I don't know if it's necessarily to deal with the PTSD exactly or just, you know, among some veterans, they may come back and have a tough time transitioning back to the civilian lifestyle. But you do see probably a higher percentage of substance use compared to the general population. And so it is something you want to be able to catch when it's there and treat it.
Yeah, and another comment about substance abuse with PTSD. As Dr. McNeil said, sometimes people are kind of self-medicating. That the substance can be essentially a form of avoidance. People may turn to alcohol or drugs in order to not have to experience some of those negative emotions that are so common in the aftermath of some trauma. Additionally, what the research is showing is that as a substance use problem develops, often people are putting themselves and being exposed to situations where they're at higher risk for re-exposure to trauma. So then you have this kind of snowballing effect where they're trying to treat symptoms with a substance and then they're getting exposed to more trauma and then the symptoms increase and the substance use increases and it just moves on from there. So they're very closely connected.
And some of these substances can actually exacerbate those symptoms. It may seem to help to numb or treat some of the symptoms initially, but actually exacerbate some of the symptoms.
Right, yeah. Right.
We have another caller. We have Pam from Bossier City. Pam, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Yes. My question is anger associated with PTSD? I have, I grew up in a household that had verbal, sexual, and mental abuse, and alcoholism, and also mental disease. I'm a recovering alcoholic for 15 years now, and I'm very involved in that. I've learned some new life skills, but I still keep I don't know, I get explosive with my anger at times. Is that going to get any better for me?
So guess, what are your thoughts?
Right, well, it's hard. I can't comment on any one specific case without doing a full evaluation. But I can say that anger is or can be a definite symptom of PTSD. We were going through those different criterion, and alterations in cognition or mood is one of the broad categories of symptoms that we tend to see. And, you know, the DSM lists anger along with guilt, shame, fear and horror as persistent negative emotional states that could develop as a result of experiencing that kind of trauma. So it is definitely a possibility, but it may not be the only reason. It's you know, every humans are very complicated, and so you know, it's hard to make any comment on a specific case, but in general, yes, it's a symptom.
Yeah, and I know, and Dr. Russell, I'm sure that you experience this also, but often we see people who have post-traumatic stress disorder that if their spouse comes with them or a family member comes with them, that, you know, they'll mention irritability, or the person themselves will mention a lot of irritability, anger, things like that.
Yeah, having kind of a short fuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for your call, Pam. I want to invite our other listeners to call in with your question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So, Dr. Russell, you mentioned support, just having that good support system. Is there anything else that you two can think of that someone with post-traumatic stress disorder might be able to do to help decrease or alleviate some of their symptoms?
Sure. The things that, you know, all of our doctors tell us every time we go, getting enough sleep, exercising, diet, those types of things, not isolating from other people and those sources of social support, the things that connect us all to one another and to people that can help us and who can be there for us. And it's difficult because with PTSD, avoidance, again, is one of those symptoms. And so a lot of patients want nothing more than to not be reminded of their trauma. And sometimes even normal, healthy human relationships will have components of them that remind them of something that is hurtful. And so that actually is, and sometimes patients will talk about their avoidance as though it's a coping skill. You know, they'll say that, you know, going to this place or to this type of place is just too difficult for me, so I don't go there. And I always tell them avoidance is not a coping skill. It is a symptom. It is part of what we're trying to decrease. And for every amount of effort that they put into decreasing their avoidance, they're going to get that back in terms of benefits, in terms of increasing their functioning and that sort of thing. So it's, in addition to a lot of do's that they need to do, there's also a don't, which is don't avoid.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned prolonged exposure therapy. I mean, some of the therapies, the treatments that we actually use are to in a very systematic way, a way that's therapeutic, to expose the person to certain types of traumas. It's not all types of traumas, and it's a very controlled way that's safe.
Right, with a trained professional helping them through that process. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have a question that was texted in by a listener. Let me make sure that I get the question correct. So the listener heard that people treated with morphine during a traumatic event were less common to develop PTSD. Do y'all know anything, heard anything about morphine and its effect on post-traumatic stress disorder?
That hasn't come across my desk. And, you know, so it might be something that's experimental, but it's certainly nothing that's FDA approved, and I haven't heard anything about it, unfortunately.
But. Yeah, I haven't either. Dr. Russell, you're shaking your head no.
No.
Okay.
No.
So, no, sorry, we don't know anything about that. Have not heard of that one. please call in with your question that hopefully we can answer. The number is 1-800-552-8502. This evening we are discussing post-traumatic stress disorder. So what about, you know, one of the things that can be difficult is if you have a loved one who you suspect or who does have post-traumatic stress disorder, getting them in for an evaluation or getting them in for treatment, because as you mentioned, Dr. Russell, avoidance is one of those symptoms. And of course, we don't want to talk about or re-experience something traumatic that has happened to us. And so families oftentimes will have difficulty getting someone into treatment or getting them in for an evaluation. What can family members do to try to help a loved one who has PTSD or who they suspect might have post-traumatic stress disorder?
Sure. As you were saying, it's very difficult often to get people to come in for treatment with PTSD and other types of mental health conditions. And if you're a family member of someone who's having these struggles, I would recommend that you learn as much as you can about PTSD. There's some great information for family members on the National Center for PTSD's website again. And so that you can understand a little bit more about what they might be going through. And also understanding that if they don't want to talk about what happened with you, that is not a personal thing. That is a symptom of the disorder itself. And giving them space and time to talk about that if they're ready, and recognizing that they may never be ready to share with you some of the details of it. But offering them forms of support that aren't necessarily in the form of taking them to formal treatment if they're not ready for that. So going for a walk with them, letting them know, I'm here if you need to talk, but I also understand if you're not ready to. Getting them engaged in activities that you know that they enjoy, making sure that they're connecting with their friends and through, you know, any religious communities that they're a part of or things like that, that help decrease some of that isolation without having to force them to open up if they're not ready.
We have another caller. We have Sherry from Pollock, Texas. Sherry, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, thank you. I came in late on your show, so I apologize if you've already discussed this, but I heard recently your last question, someone asked about using morphine during a time for PTSD, but I did read an article recently that mentioned taking antibiotics during times of traumatic situations that would decrease the risk of having PTSD at a later date. Is there anything to that?
Well, I don't know. Let's ask the doctors. Is there anything to that?
You know, again, I haven't heard of that one. Now, in terms of what's experimental, I have heard of experiments of people using MDMA, which is commonly known as ecstasy, in combination with psychotherapy. There are clinical trials ongoing that are trying to evaluate the efficacy of that type of treatment. I'm not obviously recommending that. They're still looking at how much benefit that can provide. But in terms of the morphine or the antibiotics, I actually haven't heard about any studies being done regarding those.
I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. This evening we are discussing post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Russell, you mentioned a website. Do either of you have any other suggestions as far as resources that are available for someone who has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, someone who suspects they may have post-traumatic stress disorder, or even family members?
That's a good question. Resources, and there are resources out there, and luckily our community has, there are a lot of places where you can seek help. Again, I'll touch on the fact that for veterans, it's really easy, and you can just literally walk in if you want to be seen. But there are counselors and other types of therapists all around town that are typically very available to see a patient and evaluate them.
And I know locally as well, the YWCA of Northwest Louisiana offers reduced cost counseling services to people who have been women and children who have been victims of some type of crime. So whether that's sexual assault, domestic violence, some sort of violent crime. So even if insurance or healthcare access is an issue, that's a resource that's available locally as well.
And oftentimes, I know that we broadcast beyond where we are physically located right now, which is Shreveport. Oftentimes, if you will call, contact local homeless shelters, even though you may not be homeless, or women's shelters or children's advocacy centers, even though that may not be your particular difficulty, oftentimes those organizations will have a list of different resources that are available in the community. Different providers and organizations and so forth, because they are helping so many different types of people with so many different types of issues. So even if you aren't in the Shreveport area, you might be able to reach out to a local shelter or, as I said, Children's Advocacy Center or YWCA or other social service type of organization, and they may be able to connect you with someone or another organization that can provide some kind of PTSD treatment or education information.
Yeah, and also, you know, if it hopefully that didn't sound too complicated, some of our suggestions, but a lot of times just going into your primary care provider's office is the first step towards getting an evaluation, and oftentimes they can help treat you, but also they can refer you on, you know, to the appropriate specialist.
Yeah, Dr. Russell and I work together, and we often have primary care doctors that have people come in with anxiety or depression or whatnot, and will refer them to us to determine exactly what's going on and what treatment might be most appropriate and perhaps to provide that treatment. So sure, yeah, primary care doctor, family doctor is always a good place to start also. We do have time for one last quick question. If we have a caller who would like to call in, the number is 1-800-552-8502. We are discussing post-traumatic stress disorder. So, doctors, I'm going to ask a real big, broad question. We've got a few more minutes, any last comments or suggestions that you might have for someone out there who has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, for a family member of someone who has been diagnosed with PTSD, or someone who suspects that they maybe have meet criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. Maybe they've just been through a traumatic event. Any final closing thoughts or suggestions?
Yeah, I would just reiterate that there is help available. There's if medication is what you want, there are things that have been studied and proven to be effective in that vein. Some people would prefer kind of a talk therapy route, and there are treatments available that we know that work. As we talked about earlier, it's sometimes very difficult to discuss things that have happened, to discuss the way that it's affected people's lives. But in my professional experience, I've seen where, despite someone's reluctance, if they commit to treatment and do the work, that they can often really improve their lives and their relationships and that type of thing.
Yeah, I often tell people it's going to be difficult. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it. It's right. Going to be difficult, but you know, if we stick with it, then you know, often my patients do see improvement, significant improvement, if you will stick with it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And sometimes the symptoms are a little more vague, and that can lead to a lot of confusion. And sometimes when you're confused, you don't feel like seeking help because you can't say exactly what's wrong with you. But you know, the first step is reaching out for that help and getting a professional to help you look at your the constellation of symptoms and to try to piece things together. And so even though you may not have it all figured out, reaching out for help is the first step.
Yeah, that's fine, because that's what we're here for, mm-hmm. is to try to help figure that out.
Yeah.
Right. That's what our training is in, is trying to figure it out. Yeah, so that's a good point, that even though you may not know exactly what's going on or even how to express what's going on, that's okay. We will figure out how to get it out of you and sort it out.
Right. Yeah. And as someone maybe going through the process of trying to get an accurate diagnosis and that sort of thing, a lot of times I recommend to people that they bring a family member, a spouse, a parent, their child, with them to that appointment, because oftentimes the person who's experienced the trauma will have exhibited behavior changes that are so gradual that maybe they're not completely aware of how significant the change has been. And I always will ask people, if the spouse isn't with them, I'll say, you know, what does your husband or wife say about this? What have they noticed? What have they been saying to you about this? Or I'll speak with them themselves, because the spouse, because like I said, they see things, changes that the person may not have recognized.
That's a really good point, Dr. Russell. You know, often I'll have a spouse or other family member that will be able to really provide a lot of really great information and pick up on things and notice things that the patient themselves really may not be fully recognizing as a change,
right,
from their normal functioning.
Yeah. So just be as open and as honest as you can with the treatment provider, because that's going to guide good treatment is contingent on accurate diagnosis. Mm-hmm. An accurate diagnosis is contingent on good information.
Well, thank you both. Thank you, Dr. Jennifer Russell, and thank you, Dr. Sean McNeil. I really appreciate having y'all on the program and all the information that you have shared with the listening audience this evening.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, consult a mental health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Mental Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance has been provided this evening by Tim Snell, Sheila Lawrence, and Wally Derleth. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening.